Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today we begin a special 9-part series, Women, Writing, and the Imagination. I'll be talking with 9 accomplished and prominent women. We'll be looking at the power of the imagination and the reality of being a woman in the arts at the beginning of the 21st century. And today, my guest is Isabel Allende, whose most recent book, Daughter of Fortune, has been published by HarperCollins. She is well known and loved as the author of The House of the Spirits, of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna, The Stories of Eva Luna, The Infinite Plan, her memoir about her daughter's coma and death, Paola, Aphrodite, a memoir of the senses, and Daughter of Fortune, her most recent novel, which is set in along the Pacific coast from Valparaiso to San Francisco during the time of the Gold Rush. It is a historical romance, and it's written with a distinctly feminist point of view. And I wondered where it began for you.
Probably in my own life, Michael. I think that my life has been a quest for freedom, trying to get away from the patriarchy, from the male establishment, from the male authority. And my life has been about challenging all that. When I sat to write the novel, I didn't have that in mind. I just wanted to tell a story. But why did I want to tell that story from the perspective of a woman, of a young woman? I didn't know until the book was finished. And it finished in a strange way, because it was supposed to be a love story. And then one day I came to my office with the chapter that I had to write in mind, and I realized when I turned on the computer that the previous day I had written the sentence, "I am free now." And I realized that that was the end of the book, that Eliza's journey had been a journey from Valparaiso to San Francisco, but also a journey of the soul, and that had transformed her into a free human being.
You came out of a fairly male-dominated writing tradition. And I know that from time to time, when I've spoken to some of the South American writers, they are still enormously resentful of your success. And I wondered
how... Are you talking of the men or the women?
The men.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wondered how it felt, you know, to be facing that at a time, really, when the literature of the continent was exploding worldwide, to have these traces of machismo coming at you.
Well, the New York Times defined it very well when I wrote The House of the Spirits. It said that the literary boom of Latin America was an exclusive male club. There were no women allowed. And so therefore, I'm not part of the boom. Although my books became more successful than almost all the other books, I was never accepted in that male club. So I'm supposed to have initiated what they call the post-boom or something like that. And I know that that they resent me. But I also think that the success of The House of the Spirits mainly and some of my other books opened a way for the publishers to understand that there were female writers in Latin America that they had to look for. For centuries, women had been writing in Latin America, but their voices had been silenced and ignored by an all-male establishment. Women in Latin America were not supposed to be creative or have ideas of any kind. Nothing that they could say would be of any interest, let alone something that they could write. So they were not reviewed, not criticized, not taught in universities. Their books were not required readings in anywhere, except Gabriela Mistral, who was a Nobel Prize. You could not ignore her, and so forth. So all of a sudden, publishers in Europe realized that there was a craving for Latin American women writers, because it's women mainly who buy fiction. 60% of fiction is bought by women. So they wanted to hear more of the female voices. And the publishers started looking for them. and translating them and distributing their work. And now they are full courses at many universities where they only teach women writers from Latin America.
Now, in your novel, the new one, Daughter of Fortune, one of the characters, Miss Rose, seems to be writing novels in secret, in fact. And like Colette, they're being taken away by her husband. There's a kind of family secret going on here, mm-hmm. that part of the way this family is being supported is by this woman's novels, and their concern over their good name is such that they don't want it to be known.
And they don't want to talk about it.
They don't want to talk about the writing, to accept it at all. Was this your situation in part?
No, no. I come from another generation altogether. Miss Rose in the book was living in 1840, 1850. That's more than a century and a half ago, in Victorian times, when women were not even educated. Few of them could read and write, actually. And they were, everything that they read was censored by the males in the family, or by the church, or by somebody. So it was very hard to have an education and to have any models that they could look to in order to write or do anything creative. And Miss Rose starts writing, and of course it becomes a family secret. In my case, it wasn't a family secret, but I was never stimulated to do anything creative either. I did not receive a proper education. I hardly finished high school, barely finished high school, and I never went to college or the university. And although I was a very good student, all the effort was put on my brothers so that they would have an education. And we were supposed to be an upper-middle-class intellectual family, and I say intellectual with some irony, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because I think they were Stone Age people in many ways.
Now, you had told me before that you began as a journalist, and that there, too, there was only a certain kind of story that you would be assigned, and within that realm, the story had to, the woman aspect of the story had to be presented as a gentle, very feminine, soft story, and that women were not supposed to be portrayed as enraged or in positions of authority.
Or sexual.
Or sexual. And that if they were in positions of authority, they had to be flustered and foolish, as if they were incapable of handling. Has that changed?
Absolutely. Women have taken over journalism, especially in Chile, where the political journalists are all women. And they are much braver than the men are. And they took lots of risks that men didn't during the time of the dictatorship and afterwards. And I think that today the most notorious journalists in Chile are all women. They've written books. They have defied the dictatorship. They have exposed the truth. And there is nothing soft or fluffy about it. It's extremely courageous.
So in a certain sense, Daughter of Fortune is an attempt to go back in history and give us the story of the strong and indomitable women who, from all over the world, were making their way. It was not a solely male-dominated gold rush. It was not a solely white-dominated gold rush. And this really is the story of those figures who've been marginalized by history, or by United States history, to a subordinate status. Where did you learn about them, and is it particularly learning, or is it sympathetic imagination?
I think it's both. As a woman immigrant from Chile, I can very easily write from that perspective because I know it so well. It would have been very difficult for me to write the story from the perspective of an American woman, for example, of the time, of a white North American woman. On the other hand, the research gave me a lot of material. I researched here in the United States, but also a lot in Chile. I read letters and journals and books written by people who came to the gold rush from Chile and then either returned empty-handed or remained very poor here, and they would write home.
Now, you've chosen, I think, very consciously, when Elisa, your heroine, goes to America, There are many prostitute figures and sing-song girls who appear in the novel, but I think you very much did not want to have to follow the life of a prostitute. And so she dresses as a man and is largely known as a man by others throughout the entire section of the second half of the book. I wondered about what made...
You know, that I didn't know that I was going to do that. I knew that I wanted to bring my protagonist from Chile. I needed to give her a very good excuse to come, and that excuse would not be greed, because I doubt that a woman would be motivated by the gold. She would be motivated by many other things, but not the gold. So I needed to give her some good reason to come, and I thought that love and despair were two good reasons. But I didn't want her to be a prostitute because it's just too sad. I don't think there is any redeeming quality in that condition. So I really didn't want her to go through that. And I didn't know how she would survive. Then when I started doing the research, I realized that there were several women who dressed like men and did men's jobs. They were cowboys. They distributed the mail. They sold produce from one end of the mother lode to the other. And sometimes people understood that they were women, but they treated them as men because that was how they posed. In other cases, however, they found out that they were women when they were dressing the body for the funeral. So I thought, oh, she can do this. In order to do that, I need a young woman who is not very voluptuous looking. She has to be slim so that we can dress her like a boy and she would be believable.
Yes, there's a certain point in the book when she becomes in love, so emaciated that her bones weigh less than, what bird's bones was it? Moaning dove's bones. It was a very interesting image, because the image throughout here is that love of this kind, the kind where you lose yourself in someone else's eyes, almost decorporealizes the body. And always in your work, there is that sort of joining between the body, the thingness of the world, and the spirit. And the thing that joins them is love. And it makes, in a certain sense, physical presence somewhat irrelevant.
Yeah. In Eliza's case, she's 16. She has been raised in domestic captivity. She even says at one point in the book at the beginning that she thinks that there are no men of her generation, that she will never meet a young man ever, because all the men she knows are older men. And she has never gone out into the world. At the time also, women were not allowed to go around flirting. They would become engaged very early. By 16, you were a woman, by the way. She was not a child anymore. The life expectancy was much shorter, and women would marry at 17. So they would be engaged once in their lifetime, and then they would marry that man. And she falls in love with love. She doesn't really know much about Joaquin Andieta, the lover, and it doesn't matter. He becomes a ghost from the very beginning. But what she's in love with is with her loving energy. Is that what carries her all the way through the book? There's a point in the book when she doesn't remember his face. She doesn't know really who he was, why she's following him, why she's after him in this crazy way. Why has she lost herself in this search? She doesn't know why, but she's still driven by that pure energy that is her love.
In fact, at a certain point, her love is altered by an image. A man who first has the name Todd, Jacob Todd,
mm-hmm.
Who comes to Chile to sell Bibles to the Indians in Tierra del Fuego, not because he has any religious instincts or zeal, but because he has accepted a bet that he can't do this drunkenly one night. And he, in a scandal, disappears and reappears in the novel as a journalist. He invents, in a sense, the legend of Joaquin Murrieta.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually Elisa comes to believe that this is the embodiment of her lover who has mm-hmm. disappeared, whose name was also Halkeen. And it's almost as if she is like one of those people who falls in love again because of a literary image, almost like Don Quixote getting an idea of what life must be like from the image of the books of chivalry. And I wanted to ask you about the function of art and language and words in this novel.
It's hard for me to answer that because I don't know why I write that way or why I write those stories. The characters seem to emerge from the shadows and they take over. They do things that I had not thought about. I don't write with an outline. In the case of Elisa, I knew that she was coming to the Gold Rush, but I didn't have the slightest idea what she would do here. I had a secondary character who was a sailor who was supposed to help her when she's a stowaway in a sail ship. And that character started to grow and grow, and I couldn't get rid of him. We got to San Francisco, and I say we because I was traveling with them. We got to San Francisco, and she was supposed to get off the ship, and that was it. But then he gets off the ship with her, and I couldn't get rid of him. And then in Sacramento, I tried to get rid of him again, and impossible. He kept coming back and becoming stronger and stronger. And I think that she doesn't fall in love with the image of Joaquin Murieta, the legendary and literary bandit. But she's desperately looking for a face to put on the ghost that her lover has become. And she clings to whatever she can get because she cannot accept the fact that her love, real love this time, has shifted in another direction. And she can't accept that because then all the search for all these years would be meaningless.
Am I crazy? At a certain point in reading the book, Daughter of Fortune, by my guest Isabel Allende, published by HarperCollins. By the way, you're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. As I was reading, I started to notice that the two strong women in the book, Elisa and Paulina, had names very similar to Isabel and Paula. And I began to wonder, in a certain way, was this book a form of reunification?
I never thought of that, and I didn't see the parallel between the names, but now that you say that, it's amazing how the unconscious
works.
Yes,
I think, yeah.
Because, I never thought of that.
Because, you know, as I was reading, and before I began taping this show, I asked Isabel, who is the woman on the cover? Because as I was reading, I felt very strongly that Elisa was a reforming and shaping backwards of a version of Isabel Allende, coming from the family, needing to escape the family and assert herself, and
coming to America because she falls in love.
Coming to America for love, having a constant ongoing relation with imagery, the sensuality, the play of memory, her extraordinary sense of smell. All of these are things that I've come to know of you as a writer in your other books. And especially the awakening of the senses, it seems to be the theme. And the opposite, in a sense, of the awakening of the sense is the realm of spirit. And so I just found myself falling into the unconscious of the novel, in a certain sense, yeah, as I read.
That is very interesting because when I write, I never have that in mind. And when I finish this book, I wouldn't see any parallel between the character and myself at all. I thought that this was a historical novel placed 150 years ago in a place that it wasn't even familiar to me a few years ago. So I didn't feel that I have any real... I was not connected in any way with the character. But when I went to Spain for the promotion of the book in Spanish, the first interviewer, who was a critic from El País, the first thing he said was that this was a sort of metaphor for the struggle of women of my generation in feminism. He said it's the same idea that you come out of domestic captivity and you go into an all-male world. You don't know the rules, you don't know the codes and the clues, you do not belong to the all-boys network, you don't have the tools or the skills to survive, And then this generation of women somehow did it. And in order to do that, they had to masculinize themselves very often. But then once they conquered their freedom and they became self-assertive and they knew who they were, finally, and there was a critical number of those women empowered, then they could go back to their feminine values and dress again like women and be women fully, but never again in a corset, because now they have choices. And I thought it was so interesting because I never thought of that when I was writing. I write in a sort of organic way, without an outline. The story starts to shape itself up somehow. And then some person comes from outside and explains the book to me, and then I see the parallel. Then I see why I wrote it. Why, for 7 years, I researched to write this story, and it had to be this story and no other story in the world. Why was I so desperate about this? Because there's always something that has an echo in my own life, something that I want to say about myself.
Now, do you have any idea about what's going on? I know that you don't use an outline, but I know that imagery and memory and smells and feelings from the past are very important to you in the process of writing. Can you describe it?
When I write, I am alone in a room for hours and hours, days, months, years. And I think that something happens in that state. I would say that it's like meditating, that if you meditate long enough, you start to hallucinate. Mm-hmm. And you start hearing voices, and you think that you can see the connections in the universe, and you can see the connections in time between events of the past and what's happening now and what will happen tomorrow. And in the process of writing, that is what I love. The hours and hours in silence with my characters in which things start to happen. And I'm writing about Jacob Todd at the beginning, and I know that sometime in the book he will reappear. I don't know how, in which form, or why. But why did I start with him? I don't know, but I know that he will come back. It is as if I'm embroidering a tapestry of many threads and colors, but I don't see the pattern. I'm just following a sort of unconscious design. And then one day I turn it over, and then I see that there is a design. But I didn't know that when I started.
So, for instance, the idea that Jacob is a liar and is throughout the book. Mm. That doesn't begin by shaping an idea that this man is eventually going to lie and create an image that's going to lead this woman.
No.
To very interesting.
No. And I didn't realize that the gold rush was a time when people came with a dream or the fantasy that they could reinvent themselves. Somehow that came out in the research, but vaguely. And when I wrote the book, I didn't realize at all that all my characters are like, they have like secrets. They have veils. They have layers and layers of contradiction and complex personalities. They always appear in one way and then they are something else. Miss Rose appears like the perfect Victorian spinster, and she has a secret garden where she's a totally different person. Eliza is a girl who dresses as a man and then dresses as a Chinese boy and then dresses as a woman again. The Chinese sailor happens to be a doctor who later becomes again a doctor and so forth. Jacob Todd sells Bibles, but he's not really a religious person, and then he ends up transforming himself into a journalist. So there's always this thing that we don't appear fully as the people we are. And this is characteristic of the time in the gold rush, where you would see a Chilean aristocrat dressed like a bandit mining in the worst conditions, and you would see an Australian convict who was dressed like a nobleman living in a plush hotel in San Francisco. So it was a time when you never knew who was who.
Yes, it makes me think of the line from Hamlet, "We know who we are, but we know not who we might be. They say the owl was a baker's daughter."
Yeah.
It was a very great surprise to me at the end of the book that what seems to emerge is a spirit of healing that Dao brings into the book. How do you say his name? Dao
yeah.
Shen?
Mm-hmm.
And that it is a meeting. At a certain point, they look at one another, Elisa and Dao, and she says to him, "You might be a very handsome Chilean man," and he tells her that she might be a very beautiful Chinese woman. And there seems to be a joining of spirit in San Francisco of the Chinese and the Asian and the Chilean. And I wondered about that confluence of energies in the book.
Yeah, it's the Gold Rush was a time of great racism. And during that time, everywhere in the world, in China, in Chile, in England, in the California, in all the places that the story happens, there was no space for an interracial couple. So they have to create a sort of spiritual place for them, for themselves. There is a suggestion in the book that later they will share a garden. And that is as much as this as they can aspire to in the book. But I thought that the image of the garden where they plant Chilean and Chinese herbs.
Yes, and build a pergola.
and they have a British pergola there. Like a wonderful metaphor for what their relationship is about. I am married to a lily white Irish man. and every morning when we share the bathroom and he's shaving and I'm putting on my makeup in the same mirror, he's very tall and I'm very short, and I'm usually like under his arms somehow putting on the makeup. I look at him and I realize that we are like different species, because he smells differently, he looks differently, he thinks differently. And all that has absolutely no relevance. What is really relevant is that we share the same energy and there is a soul connection. And even if we don't share the language, I mean, we do share English somehow, but it's not our native language. And my native language, and Spanish is not his native language. So there's a lot of stuff that separates us, but there is this thing that keeps us together that is impossible to describe. I don't know what it is. But I think that is what is so wonderful about human beings, that we can be so close and that the differences are really minimal. I travel all over the world. I have seen so many places. I have had so many experiences. And what always strikes me as fascinating is that the similarities are many more than the differences.
I've been speaking to Isabel Allende, the author most recently of Daughter of Fortune. I am delighted to see you again, Isabel.
Thank you
for a wonderful book. Today's show was the first of an ongoing series, Women, Writing, and the Imagination. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.